Welcome, podcast listening trainees, to the Three Men and a Retrospective's look at the entire Mission Impossible film franchise. Join IMF agents Garrett, Matt, and Adam as they review each film in the Tom Cruise starring saga about Daredevil agent Ethan Hunt and his team of world-saving emissaries. Pay attention, trainees, as knowledge of all that is discussed will determine whether you are worthy of joining the Impossible Mission Force. So strap yourselves in, IMF trainees. The Percolated Media Mission Impossible Retrospective begins now.
Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. It was released July 31st, 2015. It had a budget of $150 million, box office of $688.9 million. And this is directed by Christopher McQuarrie. Boys, we are not being opened in the winter this time. This time they moved the release date up. Why? Because in 2015, we were all about franchises. And the winter of 2015 was a little movie that the three of us have already covered called The Force Awakens. I think they were scared of that. They were also scared of Quentin Tarantino's return. And so they worked their asses off. They edited it up to about 14 days before the movie was actually released. And they ended up releasing it at the end of July. And it made about as much as its predecessor that we discussed last week, Ghost Protocol. Matt, what do you think about them kind of getting cold feet about the winter and releasing this in the summer?
It was the right move. I think this franchise is befitting of summer movie season, but it's also reflective of the industry as a whole, because it seems like every week there was a new movie coming out that was from a tentpole franchise. And we've talked about a bunch of them. Some of them really breathed life into a franchise, and then some of them, in the case of Terminator Genesis shit, were like, oh my god, we're still doing this, just let it die. And I had no clue where this was going to fall on the spectrum. I liked Ghost Protocol, but I wasn't breaking my own legs trying to run to the theater to go see this like I was with Age of Ultron or Mad Max. So I had other movies I was looking forward to, but then I saw Tom Cruise on that goddamn plane and I said, yeah, I have to go see this.
And that was my selling point too, for sure. In fact, I actually reviewed this for our previous home. Yeah, and I also forgot too, a big one that came out that winter. You think they were scared of Spectre as well?
I don't know if scared what is the right word, but I think they were conscious of it, because that one, much like this one, you have Spectre coming back and you're bringing in their equivalent from the TV show.
I think somebody at the office was, some of the bean counters were, even losing out on a couple tens of millions. That's a couple tens of millions. So smart to move it around, give yourself some runway for what you want your movie to have.
Runway. Nice. As we always do, let's look at Tom Cruise's career from Ghost Protocol to this particular film. First, he did Rock of Ages, which, my God, is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. Even as a fan of hair metal, that gave me massive headaches when I went to the theater to see that one. Matt, did you see Rock of Ages?
I love musicals, and I almost walked out because I'm not a fan of that 80s glam rock type of music. It's got the Mamma Mia problem, where I hate taking pre-established songs and having people cosplay and give karaoke level acting performances. I think that movie is insufferable, with the exception of Tom Cruise, of all people.
I thought he was good in it too.
Yeah. He was the only one who actually showed up, performed, and he has a decent singing voice, all things considered. Not saying he should put out an album like Eddie Murphy, but I thought for that role and the quality, because look, you got Alec Baldwin, Russell Brand, and Paul Giamatti should never be asked to sing in any capacity. And I had to see it numerous times. So if it wasn't for the fact I was with people I respect and enjoy being in their company, I would have walked the fuck out.
Adam, you see Rock of Ages?
I saw it and I didn't hate it. It's just there. It's, oh God, it is that cheesy. It's a Twizzler. You know what? It's not a Red Vine, but it's a Twizzler.
No, because I like Twizzlers.
I like Red Vines.
I love Red Vines. Cruise then did Jack Reacher with McQuarrie in 2012, a movie, believe it or not, I haven't seen. Matt?
Oh, I love the first Jack Reacher movie. Despite the fact he is wrong for that role, just based on physicality alone, if I divorce myself from that, it's actually a damn good thriller. And he's committed. It's the only good Jai Courtney performance that's ever been put to film. So Christopher McQuarrie should win an Oscar for that alone.
Oh, is Jai Courtney in that?
Yeah, he's the villain. I know that does sound like a lot, but when I praise Jai Courtney, please take that as some form of credibility.
Adam, what'd you think of Jack Reacher?
I have no idea.
You haven't seen it well, huh?
Nope, never saw him. And after hearing that he kind of deliberately tried to tank the Amazon series, I won't go back and watch him. I won't even give him the residual money anymore.
Wow. All right, Matt, you ready?
I'm trying to think, because what was after that? Oh, yeah.
So in 2013, Cruz got together with Joseph Kosinski to do Adam's favorite movie of all time, Oblivion. A movie that is just there. It has a tremendous soundtrack, but it is so bland. But Adam, you stand by this one, right?
I enjoy it enough. It's a visual feast. It does something different. It some of his sci-fi movies, you know, he's got that era that he did. Between War of the Worlds, Minority Report, and Oblivion, I think some of his sci-fi films are at least visually appealing with some good aesthetics and should not work, but are decent theater watches.
Matt?
Decent's being kind. I damn near fell asleep in that movie.
Same here.
In fact, I think I did for about 10 minutes, and then Morgan Freeman showed up. I'm like, what the hell just happened?
What happened? And who's this in this pod? And then in 2014, Cruz did what many call his best movie in decades, a movie I remember really enjoying. I gave a tremendous review to when I reviewed it for our previous home, Edge of Tomorrow, which unfortunately did nothing at the box office. And by the way, Chris McCrory did rewrites on that as well. It was a movie where Cruz died over and over, which was a huge draw to it. Matt, did you like Edge of Tomorrow?
It took me completely by surprise. I never read the source material it was based on. I thought it was going to be Oblivion 2.0. And yeah. I think that's honestly why a lot of people didn't go see it. It didn't really distinguish itself outside of the catharsis, if you hate Tom Cruise, of watching him die over and over.
Exactly.
But it's also very inventive for what it is. Like, I think it's got a very distinctive look. I mean, it borrows a lot from things like Terminator with some of like the beach fighting. But it's also the good example of strong female characters that don't have to browbeat the audience by telling you how tough they are.
Adam, you like Edge of Tomorrow?
Yeah, I like it fine. I think it's a good film. I think it gets widely overpraised, but I think it's good. I'll be hoping if they ever make that sequel, I'll be there, you know, ready to watch it.
I have probably watched this movie as many times as Adam's watched Oblivion. I find this movie just tremendously fun. But you know what? All of those movies I just mentioned, boys, did nothing at the box office. So we're going back to the Mission Impossible well.
Break glass. In case of emergency, break glass.
Exactly. And you know what? There was no question. I've mentioned in all these other movies, there were questions about, okay, was Oliver Stone going to do number two? Was Edgar Wright going to do the last film? This one, there was no debate over who the director was going to be. And if Tom Cruise is going to produce this, you know he's going to bring Chris McCrory on, right, Matt?
I wasn't surprised when I heard that, but I was a little, I don't want to say concerned, but Jack Reacher is, all things being as they are, it's a pretty small scale movie that was made for $60 million. There's some action in it, but it's not too bombastic because the Jack Reacher books don't go to that. They don't go to the extremes that these movies do. So I wasn't sure how he would handle that, but I've been a fan of McCrory's work going all the way back to Way of the Gun. I was definitely, of the directors outside of De Palma, this is probably the one I was most excited, especially because right around this time, if you remember, he was kind of upset that he talked about doing a sequel to Man of Steel and Warner Brothers said no.
Mm-hmm. Adam, you knew Cruise was going to bring this guy on, right?
Once Bird said that he was going to go off and do his pet project of Tomorrowland, then yeah, once he wasn't coming back, not a surprise. Tom Cruise is one of those people. He wants to work with certain directors. That doesn't mean a lot of directors want to stick around to work with him on more than one film. But I think he's found a few people, Kosinski being one and McCrory being the obvious other one, where they share some type of kinship and they've stuck it together through and they've built each other, I think, back up into box office powerhouses.
So we open up with about 16 studio logos. I always think of Matt when I turn a movie on. We have this many fucking movie logos. Before heading to a field in Belarus, Benji is in the field as Brant is asking where Ethan is. Brant says that the plane cannot take off with the package on it, and this is when we're hearing the voice of Luther, and I love Brant's response here. When Luther says that he was in Malaysia, but Benji told Luther he needed his help. Oh, I'm sorry, assistance. You know what? few things here. A, I thought they're going to bring Luther on, and much like last week, you know, we're going to see him for an instance and not see him again. He's going to be here this entire movie. I like that. And I'm also liking the correspondence between Benji and Brandt. We knew that Renner was going to come back, but he's actually a part of the team here. What are we thinking about these opening instances?
This chemistry is fantastic right off the bat. I said last week I felt like, you know, Benji and Ethan would have hung out and have a beer. I feel like all these people have hung out, watched movies, talked about their life. I just feel like a kinship between all these people here. And I think it's clear 30 seconds into this film that they have finally decided on who their core team will be. And I think it's obvious that these people are now sticking around. And I'm glad for it.
Yeah, I think this is peak. You know, this and Fast and Furious 5 prove that it takes five movies to get the camaraderie 100% right. Because it's sort of the same thing where we're bringing everybody back. Well, almost everybody at that point. Mm-hmm. But everyone passed their auditions. We saw how people responded to various characters. So it feels like the perfect mix. I also think 4 to 5 principal characters is like your absolute limit for this type of team film. Because that was the problem with Fast and Furious. Those casts got so bloated that everyone felt like they needed a moment. And it was just people fighting for screen time. But I also like that everyone has a clear assignment of what they're responsible for. Which I also think lends credibility to them as a team in a collective. And I also like the movie fucking... This movie starts right out of the gate. It doesn't let up. It jumps right into it. We're not going to waste your time. The opening is directly tied into the movie. Or tied into the overall plot, and it's also a direct follow-up to the previous movie because they mentioned the syndicate. So I like that this is a jumping right in and not wasting your time with trying to do it previously on Mission Impossible.
And I like the way they're getting exposition out here. Like, during all of this, Brandt's saying that they're under investigation for misconduct, and you can already tell the writing's better here.
Well, I think that's also because you got a director who was a writer first.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen the opposite of that.
I was just about ready to say, we've seen the opposite happen.
We've seen directors do their career and then transition to writing. Sometimes you have people who do both, like your Tarantinos, your Rodriguez's. But I think McQuarrie's perspective, I think, has really helped him as a director because he understands how to convey information in the confines of an action script. That's a hard thing to do. We've seen what I appreciate about this movie, you don't get the as you know type of monologue. Everything that you need to know is interwoven throughout. And it also helps. He structures a lot of the plot around questioning the IMF in general, which helps you ask those kind of questions and do that kind of story without beating your audience over the head with backstory. Like, it gives you an out. So I think this is a... Look, I'm gonna sing this movie's praises a lot if you remember the Mission Impossible show we did back at the old place. But I was 5 minutes into this movie and I'm like, oh, I think this could be the one that gets it right. But I was like, please don't fuck it up at the finish line.
I'll say now, to preview my thoughts, this is the Mission Impossible film I've seen the most. And I know, Matt, we're going to get to yours here pretty soon. Adam, how are you feeling about the writing here? You think it's better?
I think it's sharp. I think to your point, when you get writer directors, you know, Kevin Smith, for example, when they're building it out, I think you have somebody who can say, okay, yes, we have action scene. Yes, we have action scene and we need to tie it together. But let's do it with some quality as opposed to, I don't know, put it in the fucking 2010s version of ChatGPT and see what shits out. So I think it's clearly that it's done better. And I think it was written with an intent as opposed to being written just because.
We're seeing Luther connect them all using his hacking skills, but they can't shut down the fuel system as we cut to Ethan being by the plane. He tells Benji to open the door when he tells him. When he does open the door, here we go, right off the bat, Tom Cruise on a fucking plane. This was a huge part of the marketing of this. I remember just article after article of saying that Cruise actually did this, and he didn't just do it once. He did it 8 times. 8 takes of him holding on to this thing as it's in the air. Fuck, man. I'm loving the dialogue here with Cruise saying, I'm not in the plane, I'm on the plane. As he's holding onto the door, this is fucking nuts. And God, I have a hard time watching it every time.
Fantastic. Now, I feel like I need to preface. He is tied to this. There is safety equipment that is removed. For everybody that's like, no, he's really just hanging on free. Shut the fuck up. No, he's not. That said, it's still an amazing stunt. However, you could also just strap me to the side of a plane and film a camera at me, though I'm not signing up for that. This looks amazing. What blew me away, because I saw this in theaters, was the camera doesn't move.
Yeah.
So by choosing to shoot it the way that it does, this plane moves up and the ground rotates away from you.
Just stop.
Is so effective. It looked great. And this is a hell of a stunt. Just top notch.
It is as impressive as the Burj Khalifa thing. And I was shocked that they started the movie with it. But I think that's because they understood we need to set an expectation that we're going to do our best to not blow our load right away. It's almost kind of there's a clear confidence in the filmmaking that we know that we can do stuff that maybe is not as spectacular as this, but this is the level of quality you can expect throughout.
I do have.
And also, it continues the Ghost Protocol thing. The technology isn't working 100% because Benji can't get the door immediately.
And then he opens the wrong door.
Yeah, he opens the wrong door, which is great.
I do have to ask, though. I got to be this guy. Was it necessary for Cruise to do this? Couldn't he just do this on a fucking blue screen and it looked just as good?
I God bless the man for doing it. I think it helps because when you see stuff like this, it can look really fake. Like, I think of the bullet train fight in the Wolverine.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's so clear that they're not, like, the wind's not consistent. Mm-hmm. Backdrop isn't selling you. I think this adds an authenticity and a real sense of danger. Like, all these action sequences in the theater, I was on the edge of my seat, and I still find when I rewatch them, there's a propulsiveness to each one of them where anytime something bad might happen, I clinch up because it does such a good job of putting you in the moment.
That's a great comparison, actually, because as much as I do like that movie, The Wolverine, that scene does look pretty bad when you watch it on a big screen in high def. Adam, do you think it was necessary for Cruise to do this?
I think it is for him. I think he feels that he needs to do this for cinema. I think he feels that he is drawing people in by doing this. And I think he's, whether he's chasing his own death, chasing a ghost, or just deciding that he's got something to prove to somebody, you know, I think he feels he's got to do this for the big screen. And kudos to him. Because most people, there is no fucking way. I mean, shit, Jason Momoa couldn't even be bothered to lift weights for Aquaman 2. He bragged about the suit that he wore so he didn't have to fucking lift. So kudos to fucking, at this point, 55-year-old Tom Cruise or 53-year-old Tom Cruise at this film for strapping himself to an airplane.
You do have to give him credit. You know, people will put down Tom Cruise because of the shit that comes out about him in the press. And I'm not excusing any of that. What I will say, though, he goes all out. If he's going to do one of these films, he's going to do it, and he's going to do it with as much authenticity as he can. I know for a fact he pisses off stunt people, and he pisses off a lot of insurance agents by doing shit like this, but he is going to go all out for his audience, and I respect that about him.
And I like that he went to the production companies and they're like, the insurer's not going to cover this. Okay, fire them and find one that will.
Oh, God, I read that too.
And it's just like, you have a choice. You're either going to make a movie with him or you're not. That comes back to last week. We talked about Tom Cruise production. Guess what? He's in charge.
Matt, anything to add?
No, I mean, God bless him for doing it, because there's an alternate reality where this movie could look like the train fight from the end of the first one. And you're just sitting there going, I know I'm supposed to feel danger, but it's hard when it feels so artificial.
Benji opens the wrong door, and I love the look of pride on his face as he does so. But Ethan's yelling at him, you gotta open the right door. So he does, and Ethan gets flung into this plane. And as much as I respect Cruise and this stunt, I hate the way it looks when he gets flung into this plane. It looks about as fake as it can get.
Yeah, this is a Fast and the Furious thing, bouncing off the hood of the car.
Yeah. So Ethan makes eye contact with the guy on the plane and then flings the package out the window via parachute. And this is our pre-title sequence, boys. How the hell do you top this? So after the titles, we go to London. We see Ethan walk in a record store and says that he's looking for something rare. They go through some genres of music before the clerk is amazed that it really is Ethan and that she doesn't believe all the stories that she's heard about him, which I think was actually a dig at the press.
Aren't you a little short for an IMF?
Yeah, This was actually written for the previous film, but Bird, for some reason, didn't include it. I think it's a cute little homage to the TV show because this is a big way of how the agents in that show got their missions. I like this scene. I like the clerk. I hate the fact that they take her out, but this is fun.
I like this quite a bit. It's one, it slows it down for just a moment after that bombastic opening. And look, I dig going around in old record stores. So this kind of this calls to me here. I'm at Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley.
I was just about ready to say, how many fucking days did we spend in Telegraph?
Yep. I'm hunting some vinyl. So yeah, I like this. And as a throwback, and knowing that you're bringing in the Syndicate, it's a deliberate throwback. So I think it's perfect.
Well, it's funny. If you hear McCrory talk, it was actually completely coincidental that this was a callback to the TV show, because he had just written this on a whim, not realizing that this was a big part of that TV show. But of course, Tom Cruise, being a huge fan, realized that and was excited to include this, especially given the fact that Tom Cruise himself collects vinyl. Matt, what do you think of this?
Well, I like that it's the gamesmanship of being a spy, where you have to know the phrases. I like that they're harkening back to a bygone era in a movie that's questioning the relevance of the organization. So I think there's some fun stuff here to be had.
Ethan puts the disc on and we're hearing about the weapons he acquired. And it's confining that there is a shadow organization known as the Syndicate that is inciting a revolution. All right, so the Syndicate. Matt, you hinted at this last week, and I was going to talk about this too. People thought that when this movie was out, that this was a total response to Spectre. No, this is directly from that TV show. Now, they were more mafia-based, and it wasn't the organization that McCrory modifies it to, but this is directly from that TV show. I found that interesting.
Yeah, that's your excuse, although the TV show came out after the Bond franchise had started.
True. Okay, it's an homage to an homage to a rip, I guess you want to say. But still.
I'm not going to bitch about it, because every fucking Secret Service needs their evil counterpart. You know, exactly. Right down to the parodies, you had Chaos and Get Smart.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, how many evil empires did we see throughout the course of Star Wars run?
I wish Spectre was as well done as the Syndicate is. That's my thought. Do I feel it's deliberate? Kind of coincidental that they were coming at the same time? Maybe MI franchise thought they had a little more room before Bond got Spectre back into their fold, rights-wise. Hell of a coincidence they're both coming out at the same time. But it's nice to have a foil. Clearly, they're going to start to go a direct sequel route. And if you're going to do that, you need a villain that's going to be crossing over more than one film. And we finally got it. Five films in, we finally got it.
Well, don't forget, they brought this up in Ghost Protocol a year before.
Yeah, they hinted towards this, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love this curve, though. Ethan's told that his mission is to face his fate, as this message is actually from the Syndicate. And we see smoke form in the room as the clerk is shot by who will eventually known as Solomon Lane. More on him later. But I love this shot of Ethan's hand on the door as he falls. Very horror movie-esque. I enjoyed this.
I like how we're finally establishing that Ethan has a credible opponent to fight. Because as much as I love Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's absurd him having to fight him in any sort of physical altercation. And I always thought Dougray Scott was just a nothing. I like here that Ethan Hunt is actually being challenged, and it finally feels like he's dealing with someone who's one steps ahead and knows how he thinks.
He is Ethan Hunt. And we're going to get that as we get further into the film. I mean, the Syndicate is IMF, and I love that reveal.
We meet Alan, played by Shadow himself, Alec Baldwin.
Hey. This is him saying, I am still fucking pissed that I didn't get to play Jack Ryan more. Bring me back.
Oh, he is so angry here. He's going over what the IMF has been doing with Brandt, almost interrogating him. All right, so Alec Baldwin, here he is as he's kind of the Lawrence Fishburne from 3, but I think he has a more overpowering presence than Fishburne. I love this role. I hate Alec Baldwin as a person, but I love him in this movie.
Well, I love him in this movie because he is I thought in a lot of ways, this is if Jack Ryan became just cynical government stooge, like he fully drank the Kool-Aid. And I also think he adds credibility, in a weird way, credibility maybe not be the right word, but he's taking this seriously without being, because I thought he was going to play Jack from 30 Rock when I saw, because that's what he was doing at this time. That was what he was known for, like his SNL work. But I think he adds legitimacy to treating this is because this movie, I feel like, is the truest representation of like an actual espionage spy film. And I think he adds, you know, that questioning the relevancy and, like, how do you operate as an independent intelligence agency for an organization that is already a statutory office beneath the government in and of itself? Mm-hmm. And I think he's a good foil for Tom Cruise in a lot of ways. Because they're both pretty similar. There was a time where Alec Baldwin was trying to do the same career path as Tom Cruise.
Yep.
Like doing the big prestige films. He got to be Jack Ryan. I'm still, I like him, I'm still salty he didn't get to do more movies.
he had so many fucking chances, though. Yeah, there was the occasional Hunt for Red October. For every one of those, you had The Shadow. You had The Getaway. You had just these terrible, terrible movies that you were part of.
I like The Shadow, but it's pure cheese.
Yeah, nobody likes The Shadow genuinely. They like it ironically.
No, I genuinely, I get some enjoyment out of that movie.
Oh, that movie's horrible.
Adam, any movie that has Tim Curry in it, I will not badmouth.
Oh, we'll get to it. Adam, how do you...
The Congo is coming up. Oh. The Creighton retrospective.
I think this is the kind of role that's good for him, because I feel like he's playing this type of... I mean, it's this and... Oh, God dang it.
The Departed?
Thank you. God, I can't believe I blanked on that. I mean, it kind of plays into how he's looked at, you know, in society. So it's fine. I've never found him to be a star. I feel like he's done some good work on occasion, but the Baldwin family to me is more headline fodder than actual talent on screen. But I think this he's fine for, but I'm also, this runs the problem of your, I mean, we saw somebody show up last week to deliver a dialogue and set up Cruise for his next mission, and he was killed 30 seconds later. So I don't know what I'm going to get once Baldwin shows up, because none of these people have stuck around whatsoever.
So we see...
And we've also had a history in this franchise of government people being revealed as the big villain. Like, he could have easily been the Billy Crudup character again.
Definitely.
I do think that's what they're at least trying to tease, even though they don't do much with it. I think by casting Baldwin, you know he could be a big bad.
So Alan's saying that the IMF is outdated and that the time has come to dissolve the entire organization. The panel agrees and says that today is the day that IMF's luck has run out. We see Ethan wake up to an almost lethal weapon type interrogation room complete with the rabbit's foot. Nice little callback there. And he sees it is actually a woman who will eventually find out is Elsa Foss, played by Rebecca Ferguson. It was almost Jessica Chastain, but she turned this role down. I gotta say, you know, we talked last week that they were finally starting to get some strong women in these co-lead roles in these Mission Impossible films. Ferguson's great in this, man. I like the chemistry she has with Tom Cruise. I like how they play with her allegiance. And you really don't know until the final third exactly where she lies. This is a tremendous role.
So you're going to give me a choice and your Jessica Chastain decides she's not going to do this role, huh? Good fucking choice, because Rebecca Ferguson is astounding. Like, she is everything that they've been building for in their Impossible Women up to this point. Suddenly, just, I mean, she could be on this the side of the plane with Tom Cruise. I think she ups the game again with not just how she's written, but the quality of talent in what she does. Like, she's an amazing actress. Take her out of this. I've not seen her put in a bad performance in anything that she's done. So I think she is a hell of a get. Chastain would kind of regret this decision, because I think she's been trying to find some action stuff, you know, kind of ever since to put herself in. Whoops. But I think Ferguson is as almost a key to this working as well as it does.
I tell you this, she was one of the only bright spots of the previous movie we reviewed with her, which was Dr. Sleep.
Oh, you need to watch The Greatest Showman.
Oh, that's what I hear. Still haven't got
to it. No, you need to watch The Snowman.
Well, I've seen that, but nobody was good.
No, I'm talking to Adam.
Oh, Adam. Yeah.
Because that will question your, she's never been bad at anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys keep giving me all the clues.
All right, Matt, now it's your turn.
Well, this is the very similar to Mad Max Fury Road, where your older, established character, in a lot of ways, gets upstaged by the other female entity in the movie. I just find that very ironic that they both happened. And I think she is just as important to this movie as Furiosa was to that. And quite frankly, this puts, with the exception of Vesper Lynd, this puts all the Craig Bond women to shame around this time. And even most of the Brosnan, for that matter. Like this would be in the pantheon of Bond girls. I mean, look, there's some pretty damn good ones. If she crossed franchises, she'd be on the Mount Rushmore. But they also do a good job of... She's got the Catwoman thing where her allegiances keep changing. But I think that makes her genuinely unpredictable in a good way. And finally, someone who has sexual chemistry with Tom Cruise. Yeah. Which is the most shocking thing.
Big time. Ethan is interrogated by somebody who is known as the Bone Doctor, who was declared dead 3 years before. Ethan's punched a few times, and he tells Elsa that she should go before it gets ugly. Ethan kicks the guy down, and Elsa throws him the keys as a fight breaks out. Elsa is punched down as Ethan gets free and kicks the guy down using both feet, almost John Woo-esque, wouldn't you say, Matt?
Well, we also have to talk about do you realize the tremendous upper body strength you need to possess?
Yeah.
To like shimmy yourself up to escape that. But like this, to me, this is more impressive than the plane stunt because of just the sheer ability you need to have. So I give him the credit. Like, say what you want about Tom Cruise, he literally puts in the work, and these do feel like labors of love.
Yeah, signed, sealed, delivered, exact same.
So Ilsa breaks a guy's neck using leg scissors, and Ethan asks if they've ever met. They bail before Ilsa shuts him out of escaping with her. He asks who she is as he's getting shot at, and he finally gets out. So her allegiances are already being questioned.
Which is good, because we've never had a true
exactly
like, femme fatale throughout mm-hmm. the entire franchise.
And we don't know anything about her. Like, she's just dropped in yeah. here. We have no clue, so it's good.
Ethan calls and says that London is compromised as the syndicate is real, and he gives the name Yannick Vinter. And this is when Ethan is told that the committee has shut them down and their jobs have been given to the CIA. He says he won't stop until he finds Yannick, and this is when Brandt says this might be our last mission before hanging up.
Well, it's got to be Jeremy Renner's last mission.
Alan asks Brandt where Ethan is, as he's an arsonist and that the syndicate is a figment of his imagination. This is great. Like, again, more overpowering than Fishburne. I love Alec Baldwin's scenes of just confronting Ethan and confronting his crew and him just being totally against this organization, which a lot of people have agreed with him on, is a little bit outdated.
It is. And it's funny because it's kind of the Bond thing. You know, that they did with Craig. It's just like, oh, you're an old dinosaur. It's time to put, you know, your type of spy craft out to pasture. It's mirroring that. But also the way they shoot Baldwin, he's the 300-pound gorilla in the room. You know, they shoot him so that he looks like he towers over everybody when everybody towers over Tom. But he's seems like a legitimate, powerful threat in the way of what he represents from the system.
I also think this movie does a good job of remembering that Brandt was a field agent before he was an analyst. Because he pleads the fifth for all of his interrogations. Oh, like Baldwin can't break him. He just busts his balls. So I like that there's enough connectivity to that previous movie. I don't feel like the characters are constantly rewritten. Like I felt Ethan Hunt was rewritten for the first three movies every time.
We cut to the CIA where Alan gives the go-ahead to execute. Brandt watches as a sting operation is in place, and we're getting some maybe it's him or not teases, and Ethan is doing push-ups with a beard. Weird seeing Cruise with a beard here.
Wonder how much super glue they had to use to put that on his face, because I don't think I've ever seen him with, outside of Tropic Thunder,
yeah.
I can't think of a lot of movies where he's had facial hair.
I think he's been with a beard nonstop since Nicole Kidman in every female relationship.
All right, so we see that.
Oh, correction. Last Samurai, he has a beard.
Oh, that's right. A movie nobody remembers. We see that Ethan has been keeping tabs on what the syndicate has been doing, as Benji is seen playing an RPG.
Halo 5!
Is that what that is?
It's Halo, yeah.
Yeah, that's not an RPG. That's an FPS.
Okay, sorry. Benji opens an envelope to see that he's been given tickets to an opera in Vienna, and then he's interrogated about Hunt, being accused of helping him because of an obligation to him. And this isn't true, as Hunt is in the field and Benji is still stuck on the technical side. You know, we mentioned last week that they had given Peg a bigger role. And I like the fact that they even expanded even more.
I think it's done well. I think it's believable. And he wants more to do. You know, like he wants to be a part of this team until he doesn't. It's just, it fits so well. The way that this film is written, it has found its footing so well. I mean, it's sad it took four movies to get here, but this is just firing.
Yeah, I was also surprised that they kept the through line of him almost being his, like, I don't know, trainee, where it's like, I trust you enough to come bail me out. Also, this has the good thing of clearly enough time has passed where he's gotten better as a fieldmate.
So Benji's given an envelope with a set of glasses, and he puts them on as Ethan gets in contact and tells him to keep working, and he's being followed. Oh, and that he didn't win the tickets to the opera. He's given the plan, which is that they don't meet, and Ethan sends him a picture of their only link to the syndicate. Benji's
the police description mugshot.
Yeah.
Which at least is consistent, because Ghost Protocol, he draws Hendrix on his hand.
That's true. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So clearly they remember he's got some calligraphy experience.
Yep. Benji's mission is to find the man, tag him, and then go back to work. Ethan says that if he wants drama, he needs to go to the opera. Benji sees the Chancellor of Australia is there. As we cut to Ethan, hearing a Benji tangent as Ethan tells him to take position and then compliments him on his tux. Oh, this opera scene. So the opera starts as Benji is indeed being followed. Benji is upset that he's not seeing the world. He's stuck in a closet. And then he starts his search as Ethan shows up, as well as this woman in a yellow dress. She gets in position as Benji says something's going on backstage. Ethan heads up and spots Elsa. She loads her gun as Ethan continues his search. He makes his way up the stage and then makes the jump. He wrestles with a thug as Ethan spots an odd contact lens is thrown off. Meanwhile, Elsa points her gun as the thug continues fighting, and then Ethan kicks him down as Benji says that they're in the lighting booth. This is good stuff, man. I love this opera scene.
So this is, I feel like this movie was made for me and a lot of Bond fans, because the only memorable scene from Quantum of Solace was the opera set piece, and Christopher McQuarrie pulled down his pants and said, "Watch this." This puts that to shame. Like, this is... like, I'm sitting here 30 minutes in or however far we're in, I'm like, oh my God, this is starting to transcend just being a good Mission Impossible movie and starting to become like a legitimately good spy film, which I was not expecting it to be. And it's being played straight. Like, there's tension. I appreciate that Ethan Hunt can be punched and actually feel a punch, mm-hmm. which did not happen for some of the previous movies. And there's still the question of, okay, who is she here to take out?
I feel like Matt's got a listening device in my household because, yeah, my note on this is it's the Quantum of Solace scene, but done better. I'm amazed how well this is done. And to have the balls to say, we're going to do an opera scene when you know you're going to be compared. So you have to do it better. And it does it that much better. It's got the tension. It's got fun. You got these weapons. You got Ferguson looking astounding in that yellow dress, putting the weapons together and bullet and that lift going up and down. Like, this is such a good scene.
I'm also happy they went with yellow instead of the cliched red.
Yeah.
Ethan finds the gun and sees many gunmen firing his own shot. And then we see this Vanilla Ice looking gunman, which was weird. Ethan is then shot at before Benji comes in and wrestles another thug who is shot by Elsa, and she makes her escape. Ethan runs her down and says that he has a way out. They run across the building as Ethan ties the rope, and they jump down together. We see a car blow up as Ethan and Elsa get in a car driven by Benji. She says that saving Ethan's life put her in danger, so she had to kill the Chancellor to make nice. Setting up more intrigue.
Yeah, and these movies clearly have no qualms about killing other countries' diplomats.
Jesus!
like we still hold a grudge from World War I?
They start getting pursued. Ethan insists that Elsa tell him who her boss is before she jumps out. And we see Alan up in arms over Benji's adventure in Vienna, which left the Chancellor dead. So, of course, Benji's the one getting blamed.
Go ahead. Yeah, of course he gets blamed for it because he has good reason to suspect him. There's a paper trail. And I feel like every scene in this movie, Alec Baldwin is one monologue away from having a heart attack. He's basically like that cliched police chief.
Yeah.
Who's just so fucking mad at his subordinates that he can die at any moment from heart failure.
Yeah, it makes me think. I've seen Alec Baldwin. I mean, there's a blind spot. Come here. Let me talk to you for a second. Slam. Patriot Act.
Ethan tells Benji that he needs to tell them what they want to hear. And then he shows Benji what he's found, including agents who were presumed dead. He goes over more events triggered by the syndicate, who is trying to do what they do by destroying what created them. And then he mentions that killing the Chancellor was the start of a new phase. Ethan says that he needs to find the man in the drawing. Benji says that he's there to stay and help Ethan with his mission. Which, you know what? Benji has gotten nothing but grief for hanging around this guy, but yet he still does. Loyalty will only get you so far, dude. Ethan says that they'll start with Elsa, and then we cut to Elsa going to Solomon, who's unimpressed with her letting Ethan slip away twice. All right, so Solomon Lane. Here's a guy we reviewed last year when we did Prometheus. He's one of those idiots who went after the snake in that movie. He's going to be our only real villain who goes from film to film. We're going to see him again next week. How do we feel about Solomon Lane?
I think he's okay. I like the voice distinctiveness. I think that's an interesting touch. But I'm always a sucker for the villain who doesn't have to raise their voice. But this ties into a problem I have with the Mission Impossible franchise from here on out. Outside of next week, because there is another surprise villain we'll talk about, although a lot of us predicted it. I want to see Tom Cruise fight a movie star on his level, especially in this movie where it's like his doppelganger. Like, this should have been like a Kurt Russell, but like someone who was, or even like, I'm trying to think. Kurt Russell's who I had written down, but if you wanted to go the meta route, if this was Pierce Brosnan,
That would have been too meta, though.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. But I want someone who's walked in his shoes, so to speak, and is a good mirror, dark reflection of people. Like, I mean, Hugh Jackman could have done it.
Oh, yeah. That would have been nice. Adam, how do you feel about our villain here, Solomon Lane?
I'm sorry. Who? Erstavo Blofeld?
Yeah, Erstavo Blow, stay in your lane.
This is everything that I didn't get from Christopher Waltz that I was hoping for. I like his demeanor. I like his motivations, the Machiavellian nature that he's doing everything. I mean, he built his own IMF from people who were treated like shit, and they're doing what IMF does without permission. I fucking love it. And by the end of this film, we see how Elsa's treated. She has no reason to not want to go join the syndicate. So I love the way that this is done. I think we finally get a villain who's worthy of this franchise. Other than Hoffman, I thought was great, but that was personal. I really like the way this is done. And it saddens me because, and folks, you'll be able to listen to our show soon because we still have them all. It just rips me apart how bad Bond fucked up Spectre. And this shows how well it could be done.
So Ilsa says that if you're going to kill me, be a man and do it yourself. And then he goes on to shoot the thug in the room. And then Solomon tells her to find Ethan. And she insists that Ethan will find her.
I thought of the perfect thing. Not just because it ties into next week's movie. Solomon Lane should have been Henry Cavill.
No.
Or, I mean, they talked about Brad Pitt at one point.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, meanwhile, finds out that a safety deposit box needed for the mission is located in Morocco. So we cut to Morocco.
Yeah, where have we not shot before this?
Yeah.
Who's helping fund the film this time? All right, let's go to that country.
We see Ethan and Benji. They head to a real nice pool as Ilsa is swimming with a waterproof watch, which we'll get more of later. We see Luther land and being greeted by Brand, who asks for Luther's help. Boys, how do we feel about the rapport between Luther and Brand? It seems like they really didn't know what to do with those two, so they just kind of stuck them together.
Well, it's one of those things where you have people under contract and you have to figure out way to. I also like that everyone's kind of disparate for a bit before they all reteam, because it would have been too simple to just have them all go rogue at the same time, because Baldwin's not that much of an idiot. But I also appreciate they're actually bringing Luther back into the fold, because Brandt very easily could have just replaced him, which I kind of feel like they were setting that up.
Mm-hmm.
Not replace Luther, but setting him up to be like, he could be the new, like, Ethan down the road.
I thought for sure he had crows flying over his head.
This IMF team just shows up to the same house. No fucking problem. Sure, why not? You know, then we get Chekhov's swimming glove here in the
pool. Oh, yes.
Oh, fuck. It's random, but it's not. It is as ham-fisted, but I don't care. I'm having such a fun time. At least they're trying to address the rapport by, is Brandt, you know, going to turn on them all? So I'm okay with that. But yeah, it doesn't feel as clean as we've gotten in other films. But shit, we didn't get Luther last film. So it's almost like they didn't know what to do with Luther as opposed to Brandt this time.
You having more fun than last week?
I'm having a ball. Okay. Like, it's all of this I'm really enjoying. And even the parts that don't make sense, I don't care. Like, it's written better. It's filmed just as good. And I feel the rapport of everybody on screen is to the nines.
It should be said that Drew Pierce was the one who was hired to do this script, and he left right near the end of when it was supposed to be completed, and McQuarrie kind of took it over, and I think the screenplay here, I think you're right, Matt. I think all the loose ends are pretty well woven, and everything just kind of ties together much better than we've seen in this series previous.
Yeah, I'm also not the biggest Drew Pierce fan.
Yeah, me neither.
And I'll say he gets a story credit at least, but I look at Hobbs and Shaw and how flimsy that was.
Oh, God.
Unwatchable. And look, we'll do the Iron Man 3 fight years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Shane Black was the main writer on that, if I'm not mistaken.
Luther says that Ethan is his friend, and he will only help if he is 100% decided that Brandt is on his side. We then cut to Ilsa going over the syndicate's doings with Solomon Lane as its leader. She says that there is a ledger of the entire inner workings of the syndicate, and it is in a secure computer waiting for someone to take it. Ilsa says that she was sent to steal it and that it is impossible to steal. Impossible, you say? Not in these movies. She says
nope,
it's
because this isn't mission difficult.
You beat me to it. I had that written down and you fucked it up.
Hey, I'm just getting payback for Adam stealing my shit from the last week.
Ilsa says that it's hidden under a power plant and he'll need to pass the main gate and open three separate secure combination locks. Benji is excited because he finally gets to wear a mask, or so he thinks. So Elsa says the code is protected, gate analysis, and that it knows every tick of every agent. So, of course, this means the mask is out. And I do love these these cutaways to what would have happened if Benji had gone in with a mask as he's getting taken out. Just fun stuff here.
Look, I'm not calling last week's movie farcical, but I was surprised at how well they were putting the humor into this.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's woven really well. Okay, so let's talk about this next scene. Now, I was listening to an interview with one of the visual effects artists of this film, and he was saying that this underwater scene was a concept that was come up with. It was kind of just sitting on a board, and Tom Cruise had come to the studio that day. He's looking around, seeing what should be used, what should not be used, and he looked at that concept and said, "We're doing this one." And the guy was like, do you really want to do this? And Cruise is like, yes, yes. So as a result of that, we get this next scene of Ethan. He's told that he needs to access the turret underwater and he cannot wear oxygen tanks as the system is set to shut down automatically if any metal enters the intake. And I love the confidence that Benji has in Ethan as he's saying this. And this is the one time Cruise is like very vulnerable because even Ethan is looking like, I don't think I can do that.
But this is also how you get around the problem of how do you top plane? It's not a question of topping as far as like size, but the various ways that things can go wrong and playing on different fears. Fear of heights. This one is fear of drowning.
All right.
So claustrophobia.
When we did Avatar 2 those years ago, we mentioned that Cameron had trained those actors to hold their breath for like 5 minutes. Now, supposedly, if you believe all the press about this movie, Cruise was able to hold his breath for 6 minutes. And when you do takes underwater, it's usually done about 15 seconds at a time. But supposedly, they were able to get Cruise to do this for 6 minutes at a time. I don't know how much I believe that, honestly. I will say I like this arm that comes around. That's actually CGI, obviously. And I think that's woven in pretty well. I think the scene is suspenseful enough, though. I'm not sure about the look of it.
I feel about water the way you feel about heights. Where I am terrified of drowning. So this for me was fucking hell.
One, I dig it. I absolutely love water. I love diving.
Fuck off.
I used to. I have a father who was a trained like underwater demolitionist. So I grew up and I would take his air tank and I would sit in my pool for hours just with a fucking air tank till I got beat one time because I used all the air in the tank and he needed to go out. I remember that belt. So I love water. I don't think this looks very good. I think everything when they're breaking into the factory and him jumping in, the silo, Apple TV, I think all that looks pretty damn good. I think I don't believe he held his breath for that. I think he trained for it. I don't think it's shot with him holding his breath because I think in the water tank, I don't think it looks very good. And also, when they say that a server room is water liquid cooled, this is not what it means, but that's fun. But I got to say, because I can't escape the fact that what this film is at its core is that Lane has a knock list that he's trying to get. This film is about them trying to get Lane's knock list. And I fucking love that. Like the action here, it's action. It's suspenseful. It doesn't look the best. And I think it's the water effect. I don't think it looks very good as it ages because it feels like it's put on CG wise.
All right, so let's talk about the scene itself. Luther and Brandt, they find that Ethan actually trusts Elsa. So if you find her, you find Ethan. And they also find out that, wait for it, guys, Elsa has been disavowed. Take a shot every time you hear that in the series. So we see Ethan and Elsa, they fly down and take out a few cameras as Benji jams the signals. And then we see the water tank, the silo, from above as Elsa goes over that Ethan has 3 minutes to do what he needs to do. We see the waterproof timer on his arm, and Elsa says that when he gets to the Taurus, Elsa will shut the current down. So he takes a few deep breaths and then jumps down. Benji is in place as well. Elsa does indeed shut down the current, which causes panic as Ethan catches himself underwater. And the current stops. I like him avoiding these cameras that pass him by, though one of them takes him out and he drops the cards. Power is turned back on and this operation looks like it has taken a pretty bad hit. Ethan chases the card and grabs it before catching himself again. Benji enters the gate as Ethan starts running out of air. He inserts the card and struggles trying to open the door before collapsing underwater. but it's once again Elsa to the rescue as she grabs Hunt and revives him. And by the way, this is the second time that Ethan has died in the series. He did it also in 3. So Benji tells Elsa that he misjudged her before telling Ethan that he did good as they caught the code. But Elsa knocks Benji out before taking the code herself, and she's met by syndicate goons, and then tells them that Ethan is dead before hopping on a motorcycle and taking them out. Still, her allegiances. At this point, we're more than halfway in. We don't know what they are.
We don't. And I got to watch this film in and of itself, because obviously I've seen the rest of the series. You don't know. Mm-hmm. And every movie has been filled with backstabbing and not knowing who. And let's be clear, she is by far the best archetype to a Bond girl that we've seen. You know, we've had some women throughout the series, and we've talked about how good they've gotten. But she seems to be really that Bond girl. And which one is it going to be? Is it going to be the femme fatale? Is it going to be the villain? And she plays it so well that we don't know. And yeah, I like it. Or is she out for herself? Whose side is she playing? I like the scene. I like Cruz dying and bringing him back. I like his rapport with Benji. After that tense scene, they find a way to lighten it up. Every scene is broken very well.
I was just having deja vu because I literally just saw the new Final Destination movie.
Oh, shit.
Which, spoiler alert, involves bringing people back after they've drowned.
Benji questions Ethan's ability to drive, as a minute ago he was dead. But they get in the car and they chase Elsa around, including some stairs, which I thought was pretty fun. We see more motorcycles approach as the chase is on. Ethan and Benji, they stop before Brant and Luther, who argue over Luther getting a 4x4 for a high-speed chase. Again, the rapport here.
Funny, because I swear we went down these stairs in one of the Fast movies, and this feels like exactly what we get with Tej and What's-His-Fuck talking the same way.
Roman?
Yes.
Ethan cuts some corners as Benji expresses fright. Ethan pulls the brake to take out more thugs as he asks Benji if he has a seatbelt on. This was fantastic, man. I love seeing him pull this brake.
Oh, yeah. He pulls the brake. The car spins. Yeah. The guys in the motorcycles wipe out. I mean, that's tough to do considering you're stuck. You're in the alley. So if something goes wrong, you're kind of fucked.
And again, I'm taken back to, and I don't want to compare it to Bond films over and over, but I feel like this is the film that really tried to say what parts of Bond does well, and we are going to do those in our own way. And this car scene is one that we haven't seen done this well in this franchise. And it's good, only to be bettered by about 5 minutes from now.
Yeah, they flip about 10 times as Brant approaches them and Benji yells for them to look out. Ethan chases Elsa on the highway as they avoid cars. It goes on for a bit as they're shot at and taking some deep curves. Ethan crashes as Elsa hops on her bike and takes off.
This, I gotta say though, this motorcycle chase is amazing. This is pretty damn amazing. Okay, the locale makes no sense because we went from a city, then we went to a desert, then we went to a mountain inside of like 30 seconds. Okay, but it looks visually stunning. But the way that they're whipping around these curves, and everybody has protective gear on except Tom Cruise, who has no helmet and who is just that Margaritaville shirt that he has on flapping in the wind. But I love this motorcycle sequence up until Elsa stands in the center of the road trying to kill Harold in the stand. Just getting Tom Cruise to roll that bike.
Oh my God, this is so good. Like, I love that this and Mad Max Fury Road came out the same summer. Because, to me, this is why I go to the movies, for these kind of action films. Adrenaline pumping, there's a sense of danger. You feel the speed, which I can't say for a lot of these, chase scenes. Like, you watch, the chase scenes in the Tim Burton Batman movie, where it's, the slowest car chase in movie history. This shit's so good, and I can't say enough good things about this movie. Like, I really don't have a lot of problems up to this point, and I was surprised, because I went in there not pessimistic, but I wasn't expecting to be floored like I was.
It's not done with cheap cut, quick cut, cheap tricks. It feels, to Matt's point, you feel the speed.
We see Brant and Luther, along with Benji, they sit and ask Ethan what to do now. And Benji says that he came through because he made a copy of the disc. I like that. I like that touch. Because Benji's no dummy either. He actually came through for them.
Mm-hmm. And again, though, this takes me back to that first one when there was, I got a copy of the disc. No, I didn't make a copy. Guess what? This time they made a copy.
Exactly. We cut to Elsa giving up the ledger as she's told to go back and verify the information. She's also told to kill Ethan Hunt in order to regain Lane's trust. And then they tell her that she's without a country of her own as she's considered a rogue assassin.
Yeah, she's a freelancer.
Yep. Meanwhile, Luther says that he can't open the file due to it being blocked by a red box. They conclude that Lane is after the Prime Minister. So Ethan says that the plan is to find Lane before he gets to the Prime Minister.
God, if you're any sort of elected official in a Mission Impossible movie,
you're in dread.
Stay in a fucking bunker and never come out.
Yeah. Just stay away. Elsa meets with Lane, who says that all is forgiven. He also says that she's still alive because of her potential, but he's growing impatient. He says that he's killing to bring about change. And then we find out that the ledger she brought is empty. We cut to Elsa meeting up with Ethan. He says that she can sure ride, and he says that he knows she was just doing her job. Benji calls the fact that disk was empty to be a lie, and we see the files being deleted. He says he hopes she take the disk to her superior, as he needs to know who she works for. She gives a few answers, and she also gives some choices. One, he can hand the disk over, which causes Lane to walk free. She gives another option of letting her go free and hand the disk to Lane herself, or the third option, to go with her. She says there will always be people like Lane, and they can do anything they choose. It's just a matter of going. Ethan asks for the message that Lane wants to deliver, and we see footage of Benji getting beaten up and taken to the parking garage. Okay, we have praised this movie a lot. In fact, I haven't criticized anything in this movie so far. I think this is a really fun ride. This abduction of Benji comes out of fucking nowhere. I don't think I like it.
Well, it's not that I dislike it. It's more of, I feel like there's a scene missing to explain how they found him. But again, I feel like this adds, though, did Faust orchestrate his kidnapping to get leverage? Maybe Solomon Lane, as we know, maybe it's like a code name where it's actually her and she's running the syndicate. That's very much in play.
I like it because I'm caught off guard. As much as they are, that horrible screeching sound feedback loop and then seeing him get kidnapped, it comes out of nowhere. And I think because it comes out of nowhere, it's an easy way to set up the final stage of this, but I'm okay with it because I'm unprepared. And this film set us up to like Benji so much more than we have before. And it's like stealing a dog, man. We got to get Benji back.
It's also setting up the possibility. These movies have not, since the first one, haven't really killed off his team.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, granted, some of these, it's not like he had much of a team to work with, but you know, the fourth one, Paul Patton and company all made it through. So if they were going to off somebody outside of Ethan Hunt, Benji would get the strongest reaction, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say it. At this point, they are trying so hard to have us establish that this is a team. It's not. This is the Tom Cruise show. It's all a show to make Tom Cruise into the action star. So when I think about it like that, as much as I like this movie, it just makes me kind of turn against it because we know in the end Ethan's going to come through. And that's a problem, especially when we're seeing Benji. As you guys have mentioned, we're setting this up. Adam, you say it's an easy way to get to the next level of this movie. I say it's too easy. I just think this is just a bad way of setting us up for what's to come next.
So I would argue against that for two reasons. Number one, that argument you could apply to James Bond. You know he's going to win the day, so why should you bother? And B, We need to see Ethan Hunt finally make a choice between saving, does he value the quote-unquote mission above one of his own like team members? Because from here on out, Ethan Hunt's character is him being having a messiah complex.
But Bond is solo by design. This is a team by design.
Yeah, but I view them in the same way I view like Q and Moneypenny to Bond.
They're not in the field with him, though.
No, but they did eventually.
Well, eventually, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like M never should have went into the field because I don't like the end of that movie. Shit.
You guys, we talked about Bond years ago. Enough.
No, I'm good with it. The thing that makes me laugh is I'm like, he's got to get unlocked information to deliver it again. But I think it's being done better. So, no, I am all for this. And I feel like these films have kind of always fumbled right at the gold line. And I feel like this one has tucked the ball in and is rushing in strong.
Oh, so you're saying they're running the push-push in this movie?
That wasn't me, Tom.
Oh, phrasing.
So many bloopers in this episode. Ethan gets there too late, and Luther says that Elsa escaped. Brandt says that she set them up, which Ethan denies. But Lane calls and says that Ethan's new mission is to bring him the disc unlocked by midnight. I do like the tete-a-tete, though, between Ethan and Lane. Again, they finally have somebody who's equal to him, even not in star power, but at least in wits.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Although I am distracted, he looks too much like Phil Locke. Phil Locke, the poker player that Jennifer Tilly's married to?
Yeah, he does. Oh, God.
I don't know who that is, and I'm happy I don't. Ethan says they need to take the Prime Minister, which is how they'll make everything right. Brant calls Alan and gives their location, which completely betrays his team. Ethan says that he can't see another way of getting Benji back, and Brant responds with, well, we do what we do for our friends.
Family.
We cut to Lane looking at Benji and telling his crew to get Benji ready. Alan arrives, and Brant says that Ethan is there, but he wants insurance that Ethan will be captured alive. Alan tells him that he believes the Prime Minister may be in danger. So we see the heads of all these agencies. They meet up with the Prime Minister, and they're there to inform him that he's in danger. Brant tells the Prime Minister that he needs to help Hunt open the red box. Prime Minister says that Solomon Lane's name rings a bell, as Chief Attlee is the head of the syndicate and that he rejected being a part of it. Alan tells the Prime Minister that Hunt has made him his mission. Attlee shoots the Prime Minister, but we see the mask come off, and it wasn't Attlee at all, but Ethan Hunt!
Oh, these fucking masks.
You know what, though? They saved it, and it's actually effective. The more you save it, the more effective it is. If you use it 10 times like you did in the second one, it just loses its effectiveness, but I like this.
Well, I also like that this is the better version of John Voight's motivation in the first one, where it's,
yeah.
What do we do with all these agents when there's no... when the government has no use for you anymore? Because they're all former intelligence. I also like that they're anti-government without being full-on anarchists.
Yeah.
They don't want the oversight.
I like the motivation. I like that we held the mask towards the end. And we saw that this is how they treat agents by Elsa's handler saying, oh, well, maybe we just forget about you in the field and let you be whatever happens to you. So all the crumbs all along the way are being delivered here. And I think it's really well done.
Alan says something we've heard the last few months a lot. He tells Hunt that he has set back the USA and UK relations by decades. They give the Prime Minister the prompt of Kipling, and Luther says that he got the ledger. Attlee walks in and is shot by Ethan. Ethan says that Lane turned the syndicate against Attlee, and he asks how he framed Elsa. Ethan then gives Alan a gun, and a new plan is in place. So Hunt ensures that Lane won't take him down, and the syndicate won't be a superpower. Ethan goes to Elsa and Benji, who's wired by Lane. Elsa gives the plan away, saying that once she gets what she wants, she's to kill both Ethan and Benji, or everyone dies. So we have Benji as the avatar here.
Well, he's the insurance.
He's the insurance, yeah. Ethan says that Lane's crisis of faith caused him to lead blindly instead of a sling who was giving the orders. Ethan says that he'll give Solomon $50 million to let Benji go, but Solomon insists on getting the disc. Ethan says without him, Solomon is nothing, and the clock gets to 19 hundredths of a second before Solomon stops the clock. Solomon lets Benji go, and Ethan sends him off to Luther and Brant. Ethan and Elsa, they start shooting at Lane's thugs before taking off running. They head into an alleyway as they take out more thugs, and we knew it'd come to the quote-unquote doctor, didn't we? He takes down Elsa before pulling out a knife. Elsa fights him off a bit as Solomon approaches Hunt. She stabs Valak in the neck and takes him down.
These type of movies never have the balls to have a female on male fight. Fist fight, fair fight. This one does, and she holds her own and wins. Even last week's film, it was a pretty dang good fight with Sado and Patton, and you know, you got that classic female-female battle because you're not going to have a man hit a woman. Here, nope. Elsa's a field agent, and she's qualified, and I think it works very well for this movie and for her, and for, as I've said before, pushing that type of character forward.
Yeah, and I also don't have the problem of watching someone like the woman in, all right, this drove me crazy. Captain America Brave New World. You got a 5'1" woman who weighs like 100 pounds, who takes down like 10 guys twice her size. I hate that shit in modern movies because it just, that's not how physics work, you fucking idiots. Here is an even playing field because yep. She's actually, not only is she, look, she's not Sarah Connor, but she's buffed up. But she's got the appropriate body proportions to realistically fight this guy. And it's also not like she kicks his ass, no questions asked. This movie has also earned the right for her to, I don't want to say get punched in the face and it be okay. But in this type of world, anyone's fair game.
She trained hard for this too, and you can definitely tell.
Does not treat her lesser just because she's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It respects her enough.
We see Solomon and Ethan, they go at it a bit as the crew appears, and Solomon can't do anything about it. Ethan tells Lane to meet the IMF as gas encompasses Solomon, and he's trapped.
this was a little, I don't want to call it anticlimactic.
I will. But, I'll go that far.
But I think the reason was because...
We're setting up the next one.
Yeah. So it's like, I accept it in retrospect, but in the moment, I thought this was a cop-out.
Thought it was cool. I had no idea what the team was building down there. So when he falls into it, and then you realize that it's literally trapped him in his box, I thought it was a cool little swerve, especially because this isn't how these movies end. So I wasn't expecting this. But clearly, you're for once not killing off your villain because you need Blofeld to stick around.
Ethan just topples the cage over and Solomon is taken in by police.
Yeah, he tips it over like a goddamn cow.
I know. Elsa says that she doesn't know where she's going to go now that she's free, as she hugs Ethan and tells him to hurry. She gets in the car and says, "You know where to find me," as she drives off. We then cut to Alan at the panel, and he says that the shuttering of the IMF was a cloak for bringing out the syndicate. He says, "Desperate times bring desperate measures." So this was all a ruse from the beginning. And then Brandt welcomes Alan to the IMF and addresses him as secretary. That was the serve that threw me off the most. Alec Baldwin's going to be the secretary. As credits roll on Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, boys. Boy, oh boy, what a discussion. How'd you guys feel about the final scenes of this?
I thought this was a nice wraparound. Again, keeping the respect, getting someone respectable to be the secretary. I like that the whole thing was kind of like preamble to expose the syndicate. So yeah. It's kind of like a win-win. Hey, you came through, but you also didn't make me look like a jackass. I'll be your leader.
Yeah, it plays fun. I mean, the logistics of it don't work whatsoever because you don't reinstate an organization that's clandestine and always separate. But I don't care when it's being done. Thanks, Mr. Secretary. You're like, oh, he's part of the team. It's you just roll with it.
So that does it. Credits roll on Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, boys. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Mission Impossible Rogue Nation? Adam?
I think we've all been extremely gracious to this film. And positive for it, and for damn good reason. This is the film, and you're talking, what, 96 to 2015? So think about it. 20 years it took to get to this point. 20 years between Mission Impossible and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. That's a lot of ground. This film series had ups and downs, and I think this is the one where everything, for the most part, is firing. I think they gelled as a team better than they had in any other film. I think the work of Christopher McQuarrie with Tom Cruise being a part of writing the story and the screenplay itself, I think shows in the way that this is done. I think for the first time you have a story written to complement the action sequences, not just get you to the action scenes. I think everything in this really works well. You got some stuff here and there where you just take with a grain of salt, but you don't care because you're having fun throughout. Everything in this builds upon what came before. It doesn't disrespect any of the films. I think in hindsight, it makes them all better just because this is where you've gotten to at this point. This is that nice dessert on a decent dinner that you've had up to this point. It really complements everything. I think this is the film that really took this series to a new level. I think 3 reinvented it. I think 4 continued down the path, but I think Mission Impossible Rogue Nation finally showed what this franchise could be. And I think everything has been building towards this point and builds off of this point. This is a very strong 8. I can't quite go a 9 because I got a few little issues here and there. But I think by far, this is the best Mission Impossible film to this point. 8 on 10 for Rogue Nation.
8 on 10 from Bunch. Matt, what do you say, sir?
Talk about a pleasant surprise and an unexpected one. I thought the movie was going to be fine when I walked in. I thought it'd be comparable to the 4th one, but when I say this is the best Mission Impossible film, I think it's the best to this point by a wide margin. Because I feel like, to Adam's point, they wrote a story to build around the set pieces and not the other way around. There are some narrative shortcuts, but because the movie always feels like it's moving at a breakneck pace, you don't stop to question anything. What also helps is I finally feel like Ethan Hunt is being challenged and tested by being, quote unquote, a rogue agent, but also being hunted by a bunch of rogue agents that he needs to prove the existence of. So that story premise finally makes me give a shit about Ethan as a, quote unquote, character, which I never really have done up until this point. I think the supporting cast is utilized effectively. They don't feel like window dressing. But at the same time, they also do feel like, you know, they're not on Ethan's level because this is a Tom Cruise production. but I don't feel like he is front and center pushing everyone to the background. And I think the new additions, Baldwin and especially Rebecca Ferguson, add important dynamics that raise this above just being a good Mission Impossible movie to a great movie. I think this is one of the best action films of the last, I'd say, post Casino Royale. This is one of the best pure, if you're a spy fan, if you like just fun action movies, there's not a lot here that I think you'll be opposed to. I've seen this the most of the five up until this point, and I'm always happy to revisit it. Like, I don't have very many complaints. I love Skyfall, and I think this is pretty much on par with that, just in a different way. This is that the best of both worlds in so many manners. I gotta go higher than an 8. I'm gonna go 9. I can't say enough how good this is for me within the context of this franchise. So if I gave Ghost Protocol a 7, I don't feel like I can go just one step. I think this is 2 steps higher. That's no slight to Brad Bird, but I think having as close to a singular direction with your writer and your director benefits this one a lot.
All right, so you're going 9?
Yep, I'm going 9.
Wow. Was not expecting that. Maybe expecting that next week, but not this week. Interesting. What this movie does successfully is take everything that was right about the franchise and finally molds it into one great film. I will say that I do think the final set of scenes dealing with the villains and Benji do kind of turn me off from going as high as one of my colleagues here. I think that the movie is fantastic fun. The movie is, it's like, it's everything you wanted out of Spectre and more. When I saw this, I've never been a big Bond fan, but when I saw this, it made me excited for Spectre because I was like, wow, is this how high the spy genre was going? Bond has to take it higher, right? Well, go back to our review. It didn't. But going back to Mission Impossible, we have seen the buildup to this over 5 films up to this point. And McQuarrie was able to mold this, and he did the impossible of appeasing a vanity project for a star whose star was dimming at this point and reinvigorated it. There are great action scenes here. There's great moments of suspense. I think the final scenes with Benji and the underwater scene that doesn't look great kind of hamper it. So for that reason alone, I will go ahead and give an 8 like Adam. I was on the border of giving it a 9. And if you go back to my original review, which is on my letterbox, I was very, very close to giving it a full 5 stars. I give it 4.5. I don't think it's that good, but God, you can't do much better than this. It plays off what was done before, but does it in a better way. And the best thing about this movie too, yeah, it helps if you've seen the previous ones, but you really don't have to. This whole syndicate thing is established at the very, very end of last week's movie. You could come into this kind of cold and still have a great time. So yeah, this is a solid 8 out of 10. But next week's movie was what me and Matt were building to when we originally did this series. It is Mission Impossible Fallout. All I remember about this, because I've only seen it one time, was Henry Cavill walking with those fucking fists. That's literally all I remember about next week's movie. Adam, what are you expecting when we review Mission Impossible Fallout next week?
I think we're going to make some mustache jokes. I think.
What else is going on this podcast?
I think we're going to talk about whether or not that was a fitting end to the franchise at that point, how and why we got there, and does a Mission Impossible movie need to be 2 hours and 35 minutes, which I think is what the length of that movie is. I think there's a lot to discuss once we get to Fallout, because the press tour on that film and the marketing for that film, it took what this thing did and ups it by a factor of those Cavill guns that he reloads enough that his shirt somehow spawns a pocket. Yeah, Fallout's going to be a fun talk.
When I walked into this movie, I wanted to see the mustache that sunk a franchise. that was the big thing. Everyone was like, Justice League had already come and gone, and we're like, hopefully this warrants sinking the whole DC franchise more. But I was really hyped for this. This was the most anticipated I'd been for a Mission Impossible movie up to this point by far.
Same. I remember doing that series and being so excited for what was going to come, because at that point, I thought it was going to be the end. I thought this was going to be the final one. I want to go ahead and discuss this right now, boys. Yeah, we have 3 more films to discuss, but at the time we record this, all 3 of us are a day away from seeing the brand new one, Mission Impossible Final Reckoning. All right, yeah, we're going to get to it in a couple weeks, but let's just get this out there right now. Adam, what are you expecting with the Final Reckoning?
I have a feeling it's not going to be so final. I think it has a lot to clean up, and I think that's what it's going to do. Remember, that was supposed to be Dead Reckoning Part 2, and that changed a lot after not only the financial success of Dead Reckoning, but the massive success of Maverick, which Tom Cruise decided he is single-handedly bringing theaters back to the world. So I think that's why we have this film being longer than any, even though it's just a part two. I'm excited. I love the cast, and I can't wait to see what it does. I think it's going to up everything, and I think the trailers have hidden a lot of stuff that we don't know that's coming. Can't wait.
All right, Matt, what do you think about Mission Impossible Final Reckoning?
My biggest curiosity is, will this end with a certain amount of finality to it, to where they don't make another one, or if they leave the door obviously open for some kind of follow-up? Because say what you want about the Daniel Craig Bond films, there was no fucking way he was coming back after No Time to Die. And I'm curious if they're gonna give him some kind of real send-off like they gave Daniel Craig, or even like Hugh Jackman's Wolverine for that matter, or if he like retires, becomes the secretary. I think there's a lot of avenues they could go. But I'm curious, how much movie can you cram for a part two? That's my big question, because this, Adam's point, was going to be Dead Reckoning Part 2. And I think they changed it because part one kind of underperformed financially. Not that that fucking matters all that much, but I'm curious. I'm not as excited for it as I was for Fallout, but I'm just going to shove popcorn in my face for 3 hours and watch a movie.
We will talk about that in a few weeks. I just wanted to get that out there because this is the day before all three of us see it. But until next week, when we get to me and Matt's original end to this retrospective, Mission Impossible Fallout, this podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Thank you, boys.
Where's the disc?
Where is the disc?
You're looking at it. I am the disc. I memorized it. All 2.4 billion in numbered accounts. If that vest goes off, you get nothing. Without this money, you're nothing. Without me, you're nothing.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Go!
It's Benji. Where am I going?
They're coming.
We're not ready.
Then get ready.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
I can understand you're very upset. Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Your line's not long enough!
No shit!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So let me get this straight. When there's a mission none of you can handle, you just leave word for a nameless man and hope he gets the job done. Is that it?
Should he choose to accept?
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advanced look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
I am waiting.
Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
I got exactly what you asked for. Did you want something else?
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including The Incredibles movies, The Planet of the Apes franchise,
The Lethal Weapon series, The Movies of the Alien franchise,
The Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, Jurassic Park,
the ongoing Marvel series,
and so many more.
Well, this is not Mission Difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's Mission Impossible.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
He made it! He made it!
I knew he'd make it.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You want to shake hands with the devil, that's fine with me. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell.
Scheduling by Matt.
Read this. Slowly.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Listen. Talk to me. We can talk. Like gentlemen.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Reggie, did you recover anything?
Yes. Despite the aforementioned conditions of the hard drive you brought back, I managed to recover portions of 24 email files. Also made what I believe to be a thoroughly promotion-worthy breakthrough.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You wanted me to listen. This is me listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
That was not easy, but I did it.
He sees it is actually a woman who will eventually find out is Elsa Frost. Elsa Frost. And you really don't know until the final third exactly where she lies. This is a tremendous role. Matt.
Go to Adam first, because he's been very lip sealed. We got to let him go before he explodes.
All right. Go ahead, Adam.
So you're going to give me a choice.
Adam, how do you feel about this rapport between Luther and Brant?
I'm sorry, I'm still distracted by the rapport between Rebecca Ferguson and the pool.
Oh my God.
Just because I don't understand how, if she's being watched.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's woven really well. All right, go ahead.
You know what? I'll wait till we get into it.
Okay, so let's talk about this next scene. Now,
you feel the speed, which I can't say for a lot of these like chase scenes. Like you watch like the chase scenes in the Tim Burton Batman movie, where it's like the slowest car chase in movie history. This shit's so good. And I can't say enough good things about this movie. Like I really don't have a lot of problems up to this point. And I was surprised because I went in there not pessimistic, but I wasn't expecting to be floored like I was.
It's not done with cheap cut, you know, quick cut, cheap tricks. It feels... You, to Matt's point, you feel the speed.
It's definitely got some mighty wings, doesn't it?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I realized I said the need for speed, and I thought of fucking Goose.
Was Mad Max summer or was that late spring?
That was May. That was May.
Okay. Was it official summer?
Summer movie season starts in May now.
Okay. Even 10 years ago?
Yeah, because okay. Age of Ultron was like the first week of May.
Yeah.
Thanks, Spider-Man.
I think Mad Max was like the Memorial Day weekend.
Okay.
Which nothing screams America like Australian action movie.
We see. And she also gives some choices. Where'd Matt go? Matt just dropped off the call.
Whoop, saw that. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh is right. Do I need to re-invite him?
I think you can click on the same one.
Oh, it just disconnected for some reason. Okay, he's going
to internet disconnected. One sec. Okay. Damn syndicate.
Right.
Damn it, Benji.
That might be Tom Cruise coming after us, actually, due to some of your comments.
I knew I shouldn't have made a comment about the beard. It was a Spielberg joke.
God damn it. We're having such a good discussion, too. Fuck.
There we go. That was weird.
Yeah. Your internet just disconnected. We thought maybe it was because of Adam's bad Tom Cruise gay jokes that they've just decided to take it out on you.
I could pass better than he could.
She gets in a car and drags, you know where to find me. And I'm sorry. She gets in the car and